From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during the presidential campaign in the summer of 2016. Then-candidate Donald Trump made clear that if he won the election, we could expect him to pursue tariffs. With Mexico, maybe, China, perhaps others. Big tariffs, he promised. 35%, 40%. It was time, Trump declared, to stop being a doormat. And so for some reason, the world has reacted with shock opprobrium to his announcement last week that, yes, he's going to pursue steel tariffs. The president tweeted, quote, "When a country like the USA is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win. Example, when we are down $100 billion with a certain country and they get cute, don't trade anymore. We win big. It's easy," end quote. This hour, we reached out to a number of people who analyze such matters. I'll say from the outset, I don't know where our guests today stand on tariffs, but it has been difficult to find many people who openly support tariffs. We do want to hear from our listeners. Any questions you have this hour? I have plenty as well. And let me go ahead and welcome our guests in studio. Rob Shum is a former trade diplomat and a public policy professor at the college at Brockport. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Kent Gardner is a principal with the Center for Governmental Research. Welcome back, Kent.
Thank you, Evan.
And Amit Badabial is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. Amit, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
I want to start by listening to what the president recently said about trade wars and tariffs and all of these related matters. This, courtesy of the BBC, this is the president.
The fact is we weren't treated and we haven't been treated fairly by other countries. But I don't blame the other countries. When I was in China, I said, listen, President Xi, I have a lot of respect for President Xi. I said, I don't blame you. If you're able to get away with making almost $500 billion a year off of our country, how could I blame you? Somebody agreed to these deals. And those people should be ashamed of themselves, what they've let happen. So we're bringing it back, and we're going to bring it back relatively rapidly, and we're going to be instituting tariffs. Next week, we'll be signing.
Rob, should the people who have set up those trade deals be ashamed of themselves, as the president says?
No, well, I'm certainly not ashamed of myself for my work on NAFTA. I think this is, again, I know that there is emotion out there that we've said before. Actually, you've quoted, I think, Amit before, last time I was here, about this, the fact that the problem is that everybody can see jobs being lost and blames that on trade, but nobody sees the jobs being created from trade agreements. And so you have this this knee-jerk reaction, assuming that protection is good when it's not, when, again, all of the estimates are that the current round of tariffs will actually result in a net loss of jobs in steel-consuming industries. And that's why, again, we saw Boeing and Caterpillar and these other, and Ford lose share value, because people obviously can tell that there are losers. There are the consumers, including consuming industries, that lose from protectionism. But that's a counterintuitive sort of thing for many people to understand.
All right, Kent Gardner, the president says when he talks to leaders in China, he says, look, I don't blame you guys for beating up on us. We let you do it. Is that a fair read of the situation?
Well, I think that we have to ask the question of whether trade deficits are in fact negative. I mean, the president is, I think, using a very a narrow and I mean, pardon me, but I think a kind of a naive understanding of a trade deficit. What trade deficit means is that they're willing to accept our dollars in exchange for sending us goods. And because we have this this remarkably successful and strong currency, they're willing to keep those dollars. They're not just simply trading them and putting them back on the market, so the supply of dollars goes up, but they keep them, and they use them to buy things like U.S. Treasury securities. So much of when we run a deficit in the United States, for many good reasons, to support our people, to support our welfare programs, our healthcare programs, part of that is being financed by the Chinese being willing to buy our debt. Our interest rates and our borrowing rate is very, very low as a consequence of that. So, you know, the whole trade deficit question is a much more complicated one. We could go on an entire hour talking about the, you know, what's good and bad about a trade deficit. Long term, there are certainly some risks, but short term, I mean, the president is thinking of this as I think very narrowly.
Okay, Amit Badabial, is the president right in any way to say that we have made mistakes and the Chinese are whooping up on us on trade and that we should be ashamed of that?
Well, that's a very simplistic approach to the actual problem that exists. I think we have to separate two things here. One, it is true that certain segments of the American working class population have been very adversely affected as a result of China, free trade with China. But to then make the next leap of faith and argue that that means the Chinese or Canadians or whoever his, you know, whipping boy happens to be on that particular day is a country we should be putting up protectionist barriers is super simplistic, and it's unclear whether it even hurts, benefits the United States as a whole.
Okay, and I think, I don't want to misquote you. I remember from a past discussion, Amit, you said one of the mistakes in our policy has been it's not that we should be attacking free trade or throwing out agreements, but also recognizing that for the segment of the manufacturing population that has perhaps lost some mitigation for them, some
right.
assistance. Yes,
right, right. That's true. So let me backtrack a little. So every trade model that I teach my students and researchers in trade theory are aware of says that there will be winners and losers from trade. There's no question about that.
It zero sum, though?
No.
It's not zero sum.
That's what I'm coming to.
Okay.
So there will be losers from trade. So there is no trade model which says that everybody gains and hence there's nothing to worry about. So the question is, what do you do from the standpoint of the government about the people who have lost from trade? And I think the quotation that you were mentioning a minute ago, there I was arguing that as a nation, with programs like, for instance, the TAA, the Trade Adjustment Assistance, we do too little to help those who have been adversely affected by trade. But remember, I am not suggesting that we should have in place protectionist barriers such as tariffs to help those people. There are other ways in which we can help the disadvantaged or people who happen to be in the import competing sectors other than tariff-related instruments.
All right, so our guests do not support this move towards steel tariffs, but let me ask all of our guests, and in a moment I'm going to play an interview from this morning. You heard a brief clip of it of Congressman Tom Reed talking to NPR and Steve Inskeep. You're going to hear that extended conversation in just a moment to get a better perspective on why some Republicans in Congress could support these tariffs. Let me ask all three of you, and I'll go back around the table. Amit, what is the scenario in which you might say a tariff of any size is appropriate? Is there a scenario that you can envision that?
Normally, if you're a large country, in other words, you have market power and hence are able to influence world prices, there is a strategic case that one can make for pursuing what trade theorists call an optimal tariff. However, we live in a multilateral world where our economy is integrated with the economies of the rest of the world. So if we pursue something like this unilaterally, other countries are not just going to sit down and do nothing about it. They will retaliate. So it's the retaliation and then subsequent round of potential tariff raising that's likely to lead to a so-called zero-sum trade war. So the short answer is that in contemporary times, it's very difficult to come up with a realistic scenario where a tariff makes sense.
Okay. Kent Gardner?
Well, there are certainly cases in which we have other countries engage in activities that reduce the total amount of exports from the United States. And there are places in which they put non-tariff barriers in place, for example, that do discourage exports. And we should, rightly complain about those. And certainly a little bit of saber rattling around tariffs can sometimes be helpful. I mean, I think that, you know, a little bit of good cop, bad cop is not a bad thing. I'm not saying that we should roll over and reduce our tariffs to zero and simply let people take advantage of us, which they do occasionally. I mean, I think that the president's instincts are correct that other countries would be delighted to take advantage of us to the extent that they can. So once again, threatening tariffs once in a while might be helpful, just as a way of reducing some of those non-tariff barriers that can unfairly disadvantage trade. So it's not that trade's always fair and that zero tariffs would necessarily be good for us, but this is a particularly crude and I think unhelpful play. I mean, if you think about this, trade is a very complicated game. It's trade negotiations are multi-level chess, and this really looks like an opening move in tic-tac-toe.
But Kent, in this case, it does sound to me like you think that the notion of saber rattling doesn't also carry the intent of using them. In other words, it sounds like tariffs are economic nuclear weapons, which is you want to stockpile at your disposal with the intention of never having to use them.
Well, I think that's correct, although, you know, sometimes we have used in the past, we have used temporary tariffs as a way of, making it clear to other nations, our trading partners, that we're really serious about having them address some of the unfair trade practices. But this was just a really odd one. I mean, the production sector for steel and aluminum to throw a tariff onto steel and aluminum, it's just a really strange place to start. If you know, just from an employment perspective, just to make sure that it's clear, there are about 140,000 people who work in the production sector in steel and aluminum. The fabricated metal products sector employs 1.4 million. The machinery sector employs 1.1 million. The heavy and civil engineering construction employs another million. So that's 3.5 million jobs that are put at risk. These are heavy steel using industries in defense of 140,000 workers in the production sector. It just is, it's a really odd place to start saber rattling.
All right, Rob Shum, make a case for a tariff at some point. Can you?
Yes. Well, I mean, reasonable people can agree or disagree over the issue of steel, global steel overcapacity. And so the challenge is, how do you respond to that? The United States has already played anti-dumping and countervailing duties on Chinese steel, and Chinese steel only accounts for approximately 1% of steel imports into the United States. So the challenge now has been for patient diplomacy with our allies to get them to coordinate actions, to agree that China has been breaking the rules. And so we use our institutions that we've developed, right? The rules that we've written at the World Trade Organization and in our trade agreements. And that is, you know, it doesn't get the headlines, it doesn't get people going at rallies, but that's the way you do trade diplomacy in the world today. And what the proposed measures do, of course, is the opposite. It instead threatens our allies, gets them upset, right, and undermines cooperation. This is, China is laughing at us. They could not have invented a better outcome than to have the United States engage in this kind of action.
Now, before we listen to Congressman Tom Reed, I just want to press one more important point here. I said before the hour began, when I came into the room and our guests were here, I didn't know where they stood on tariffs, but I wasn't having much success. I was not having much success finding different voices anywhere who support tariffs. And I joked that, well, this is going to be the groupthink hour. And Kent said, oh, call it groupthink or call it what? Just a sort of decades of experience and data?
I mean, your rational policy. And I mean, occasionally groupthink makes it sound as though we're kind of jointly deluded. I think that we've actually been looking at the same data over these many decades.
Do you have any colleagues who are really adamantly, vociferously pro-tariff?
Not among economists. I mean, I don't. If there are I think Amit and Rob both talked about some issues that where we know that we can have fairer trade, and we need to be have a sophisticated approach to our trade negotiations. It isn't as though there aren't aspects of these various trade agreements that couldn't be improved. I mean, we have our complaints and our complaints about the pieces of the TPP. We certainly have our complaints about NAFTA. So there's a sophisticated conversation to be had. This just doesn't happen to be one of them.
Okay, Amit?
So one of the things that I want to point out is that in the post-World War era, beginning with the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, and then its subsequent organization, the WTO, the United States has been at the helm of the liberal world order in reducing countries across the board, pretty much, with a couple of exceptions, in getting tariffs reduced to their very low levels. The WTO is largely our creation. There is clearly built into the WTO a dispute resolution mechanism. Those are the kinds of fora where we should be pressing our case, whether it's against China or Canada or whoever. I'm not naive enough to suggest that, you know, other countries are not doing things to try to pursue beggar thy neighbor policies. But the question is, when one is aware of the existence of such policies, what is the appropriate way to respond? It's not to use a policy instrument, in this case a tariff, which has largely been disused over 40 to 50 years for good reason, and say, well, we're going to make America great again by using these kinds of tariffs. There are many other things that we can do short of this, you know, blunt instrument approach to the underlying problem, which is nuanced.
All right, listeners, as we get ready to listen to the congressman here, I want to appeal to you with any phone calls or questions or comments you've got on trade. And in particular, if you find yourself at least thinking, is the president really wrong here? If you find yourself sort of gravitating in the direction of at least instinctively thinking there might be something wise with tariffs or starting a trade war, as the president recently has been tweeting about, call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And please call knowing that I think everyone on this panel understands the visceral feeling that people have when they see wage inequality or they see, you know, sort of the classic picture of manufacturing losses, the Rust Belt, but it's really happening in a lot of smaller and mid-sized cities. There's a lot of understanding about that frustration. And so no one's gonna laugh at any comments or questions I or you have about this, but we want to work through it. So if you want to call the program, do that. I will also say it's probably not just Donald Trump voters who might feel this way. This is one of those places where there's some overlap among Bernie Sanders supporters. And again, I'm not speaking monolithically, but there is more suspicion on corporate concentration, trade, and an imbalance there among typical Bernie Sanders supporters. So if you've got comments or questions, it's a good chance to do that to weigh in here. Let's listen now to what Congressman Tom Reed, a Republican, of course, from Western New York, said this morning about tariffs, trade wars, and more on NPR's Morning Edition with Steve Inskeep.
The president has said he's happy to do a trade war. Trade wars can be good. Do you believe a trade war can work?
No, I'm obviously concerned about any trade war, but I do understand what the president's doing, and I support the action he's proposing on taking and getting people to the table, our trading partners, to enforce the rules of equal and fair trade.
Let me make sure I understand this. Does that mean you want the tariffs to be imposed?
I am open to what the president is putting on the table. I believe he's sending a good message across the world that the trade policy of America has changed. We need to be much more aggressive to protect our steel and our aluminum, as well as our overall economic cores. But at the end of the day, I believe he will agree with us that a trade war ultimately is no one's interest, and that this is about getting to a fair policy that each country can represent in good faith and compete on an equal and level playing field.
I think you're saying that you don't want to directly confront the president. You think this might be okay as a negotiating ploy, but actually imposing the tariffs would be a bad idea. Is that what you're saying?
I think I'm open to tariffs being employed against our trading partners that have a long history of abusing that trading relationship. And this is another tool in the toolbox, in my opinion, to send the message and also to hold those trading partners accountable for their bad actions. When you have a country like China that is dumping steel and aluminum being dumped into our markets from other trading partners, that is not sustainable. And what the president is doing is exactly what I believe needs to be done, is that this is to change the trading policy of America, to say to the rest of the world, we're not going to do that any longer. We're not going to accept that any longer. And at the end of the day, what will end up happening, in my opinion, is that we will get trade agreements that are truly fair, equal, and enforceable. And those are the trade agreements I have supported in the past, in my opinion, and those are the trade agreements I will support in the future.
What do you think about the fact that the loudest complaints about the president's promise or threat have not come from China? They've come from U.S. allies like Germany.
I know. And that is exactly issue that's afoot. But we've had other trading partners, other countries around the world that have dumped their steel and their aluminum into our marketplace. And I think this is a marker to send a message not only to those trading partners, such as other countries that we have relationships with, but also the relationship we have with China, to say that there's going to be a new trading relationship under this administration's direction that is going to say that's not acceptable any longer. And I think that overall, in the long run, will be positive. Now, obviously, I'm very concerned about the short-term impacts. I'm very concerned about igniting any type of trade war. But at the end of the day, we need to change our policies because the status quo is not something that can be sustainable under the existing trade relationships we have.
Doesn't the domestic steel industry in the United States still make 3/4 of American steel?
That's absolutely correct. I believe that's an accurate number. And I believe, however, that there's opportunities for that steel base to expand. And with the unfair competitive edge that these other countries, such as China, are deploying against us, it limits our ability to grow our steel industry and our aluminum industry.
All right, that's Congressman Tom Reed talking on this morning's edition of Morning Edition with Steve Inskeep on NPR. Our phones are flooded, so first what I'm going to do is grab a phone call, and I think what we'll do is we'll let our guests who are in studio with us also respond to your calls and what they heard from Congressman Reed. In studio with us are Rob Shum, former trade diplomat and a public policy professor at the College at Brockport, Kent Gardner, a principal with the Center for Governmental Research, and Amit Badabial, the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. We're going to start with Jim in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. I kind of want to echo the previous caller. And I'd also like to add that I think this discussion, maybe I'm coming a little late, but it seems a little one-sided. I don't hear any economists or any opinions that are espousing, agreeing with what's being done. And am I missing something?
No. So, Jim, what I said at the outset was I invited Kent, Rob, Amit, and actually a number of others. We always do that, and we always invite a number of people from a lot of different backgrounds. I didn't know in this case, given their expertise, I wanted their views on this, but I didn't know their views on tariffs. It turns out they are anti-tariff, and Kent said earlier he doesn't know any of his economist colleagues who favor tariffs. So it's hard to find people in this case with actual expertise who think this is a good idea.
Okay. Well, I think some efforts should be made to include someone that's offering a counter opinion rather than, I realize maybe it was a mistake, but as a listener, it's a bit insulting. And the inference is that, well, we just couldn't find anyone. Oh, there's no one out there that's intelligent enough to come out here and actually discuss this. And that's a little disheartening.
You know, if I can comment.
Yeah, Jim, stay there. Go ahead, Kent.
Yeah, if I can comment, I mean, I think you also have to take a look at the division within the administration. They're relatively, you know, Gary Cohn, the head of the Council of Economic Advisers, advised against this. You know, Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, advised against this. You know, I've forgotten other people from the administration. So even the president's administration is. The support for this particular action is pretty thin.
There was a report today that there is word that Gary Cohn is going to quit if these tariffs go forward. And this is one of the most important people to Trump. So I guess, Jim, what Kent is saying there is even within the Trump White House, there are a lot of heavy hitters who say this is a bad idea. Trump has sort of at least thus far overruled that. His own party, Paul Ryan and others, have said bad idea. You just heard Congressman Tom Reed. I've been desperate for any voice I can find that has expertise or policy sway to come on and defend this. It is not easy to find it, but I'm certainly open to it.
Well, here's what I would add to people in his administration being against this. I would postulate that perhaps across the board, economists are infected with the same sort of flawed thinking about what's considered economically good. What's considered the best way to go? And I think there's a connection between much of the economic policies that we've had over the last 50 years and the social disintegration that we've had over the last 50 years. And I don't see any responsibility being taken from that end. It's almost like, yeah, we're just going to continue to do the same things we've always done because that's what the models say we should do. And, well, maybe success isn't measured by the stock market alone.
So, Jim, thank you for the phone call. I'm going to take Jim's comment. I'm going to follow up starting with Amit because Jim is raising a point that I hear in a lot of places, which Amit right. Essentially is this. As you said earlier, there are winners and losers in trade, even though it is not a zero-sum game. And to the extent that there are losers, we have to find ways to help and be more helpful when we do identify losers, often in manufacturing.
Right.
That sort of presupposes, though, that this was the only option. And Jim's phone call says maybe there is groupthink. Maybe that whether it's economists, public policy, this idea of trade as always sort of a net benefit overall misses the point that we've had a middle class hollowed out, that we've got wage inequality, we've got corporate concentration, and then it presupposes that we just have to accept that manufacturing is going to be done elsewhere and it's right. not going to be done here. Is that true?
No, but I think what Jim and several other listeners are tapping into is a basic sense of resentment / fear, where they think that free trade is basically resulting in the lunches of Americans being eaten by foreigners, and our government seems to be doing nothing to protect us. Instead, they seem to be more interested in mollycoddling foreigners. The problem with the way in which economists make arguments about free trade is the following. Now, in simple English, what economists will tell you when they say that free trade is better than some kind of managed trade is that the winners win by more than the losers lose. I'm putting it very simplistically. So if the winners win by more than the losers lose, then it's in principle possible to take some of those winnings from the winners, compensate the losers, and yet come out on top as a nation. But the problem is that no compensation is typically ever made to the losers. So the argument about the superiority of free trade rests on a conceptual principle which is rarely actually implemented.
So what would it look like?
So, for instance, we have programs like that on the books, such as the TAA, the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, but it's puny. It's a drop in the bucket. We need to significantly expand those kinds of programs to help those people in sectors of the economy, a lot of which happens to be manufacturing, who have been adversely affected as a result of trade. But we never do that. Sequentially, politicians come and promise this and that, but once the elections are over, their time is over, it's back to square one. So this sequential promises and not actually doing anything to affect the benefit of those people who are adversely affected by trade builds a significant amount of resentment. And I think this is one of the key reasons that explains, at least from an economic perspective, why President Trump won in 2016.
Sure. And Kent, before I get back to your phone calls, Kent, you know, I hear Jim saying, well, maybe you all have it wrong. Look at our country. We can do much better.
Well, I understand the sentiment, but I guess one of the things I'd say back to you, Jim, is that perhaps it's easy to look on the outside and assume that we economists all agree, and that's far from the truth. There's a tremendous range of opinion, particularly on trade issues. So you take someone from like a libertarian like Tyler Cowen, and then go to the other extreme to a liberal like Paul Krugman, and you'll find a tremendous range of disagreement about how to handle trade issues, about what constitutes a fair trade agreement. And this is one case where, you know, I'm sorry, Jim, but, you know, across the spectrum, this particular policy suggestion is viewed as being not really wise. So, you know, the president didn't really consult with his advisors much before he issued this. This is a case in which I think the president is out of step with his own base and out of step with people who generally are supportive of his policies.
Rob, I'm not asking you to defend the host here. I'm asking you if, because Jim's insinuation, which, if you just tune in the middle, I get where Jim's coming from. But it sounds like the host just didn't even attempt to find all the pro-tariff people.
Well, I think the issue here is that on tariffs, just to echo what Kent is saying, it's like, if you invite a bunch of physicists, you're not going to get anybody who's going to deny the law of gravity. Tariffs are a bad idea because we've seen them in action in the 1930s. We also just know in theory, I mean, there's distrust of the models, but the models are clear. Tariffs are taxes. And tariffs are not paid by the foreign manufacturers. They are paid by American consumers of imports. Tariffs raise the price of foreign goods, and they also raise the price of goods made in the USA, making those goods less competitive in foreign markets. That's why they are bad. And yeah, unfortunately, we all agree, but we all also agree that the earth is round, or most of us do.
Okay, Amit, go ahead.
And I just want to point out that, you know, we don't have to go back many years. There was a similar set of events transpiring that led George Bush, the junior, in 2002 to, in fact, levy tariffs on steel. And now, 16 years later, we have data to see what those set of tariffs actually accomplished. And there is really no reason to believe that it did much in terms of job creation, the professed benefit of many of these implementers of tariffs in the first place.
Okay. This is not the first president to push for tariffs, is an important point.
It's true.
And there have been Democrats who've done the same, right? Fair? Yes? That's true? Okay. He's not inventing a new wheel here. Before I get back here, I was going to go to Nicholas in Rushville. I see we've lost him. Nicholas, give us a call back. We'd love to hear from you. Let's go ahead and get to Charlie in Seneca Falls next. Go ahead, Charlie.
Two comments. For the gentleman who wanted a reputable defender of tariffs, it would be like asking you, Evan, to find somebody to defend the flat earth. You're not going to find reputable defenders of tariffs by anybody who's got any sense of economics. Secondly, if you study history at all and you go back and look at every time we've tried to do tariffs, they've failed miserably and made situations worse. go back to 1929, 1930, and trying to protect the United States by having tariffs, it only made the Great Depression worse. And that's it. I'll listen off the air.
Well, Charlie, thank you for the phone call. I don't know if it's that hard. I will tell you, just to peel it back a little, literally this morning I Googled in defense of tariffs to see if there's any thought pieces out there in the last 48 hours where somebody's saying, you know, Slate magazine will defend anything, you know, and not even the Slate has found someone to do a contrarian piece on tariffs. But I'm sure there are. And in a moment, I'll read some comments that at least push back mildly, though I don't see big defense of tariffs as such. Well, but go ahead.
Well, Evan, just one thing. I mean, I think that if we understand that trade is a long game, and if you're really in a dominant position, we could impose tariffs and we could benefit from those tariffs for a period of time. I mean, if you this is what we call a mercantilist perspective, right, that we're going to set up a trade situation that's manifestly unfair, and because we're the big guy on the block that we can get away with it until we can't anymore. So again, trade's a long-term game. So maybe it would appear that we could throw on some big tariffs and benefit for a time. You know, it doesn't last forever.
All right, we're going to go to Nicholas in Rushville, David in Brighton after our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we'll get those phone calls. Got a lot of listener feedback on the subject of tariffs, trade, and more. You just heard Kent Gardner with the Center for Governmental Relations Research. My gosh, relations. What are you, a diplomat now? Center for Governmental Research. Rob Shum is a former trade diplomat and a public policy professor at the College of Brockport. And Amit Badabial is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. Right back to your phone calls after our only break. Coming up in our second hour, the case of local rapper Randy Ross. He's charged with making a direct terroristic threat after releasing a new music video. The video is for his song, School Shooter. And in the video, he raps outside of a local high school. He talks about showing up at lunch, emptying a clip. He talks about laying him down like a school shooter. For the police, that was enough to say it's a direct threat. He says it wasn't. Let's discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've got a lot to get through with your phone calls. Nicholas in Rushville next. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Hi. I'm, for starters, I'm a huge fan. I work in factories for the last, like, 3 or 4 years, and I think I'm to the point where I'm a bit of a isolationist. I mean, I think we have the resources in this country to function on our own. Why do we need to rely so heavily on foreign materials to start with, you know? So I think tariffs push for use of American resources. I don't think that's such a bad thing.
Okay, so please stay there, Nicholas. I'm glad you called. That is
yes.
That is a sentiment you do see from a significant number of American workers. And let's start there. We'll go around the table. Professor Badabial first.
Right. So one of the key problems with being isolationist and relying only on what you can do within the country is that you can show pretty clearly that you're not using scarce resources efficiently. So, for example, the multitude of American companies that are in the business of whatever it is that they're doing, that is typically profit maximization, their job is to raise revenues and to lower costs, particularly more so if they happen to be a publicly held company where their job is to maximize shareholder revenue. So, for instance, if the cost of doing activity A in the United States is $3 and the cost of doing that same activity in the United Kingdom is $2 and there are no differences in quality, are you going to tell that company that you should not be engaging with that UK entity, even though it's cheaper from the standpoint of cost? So that's one example. But one can give many such examples to show that generally countries benefit when instead of being isolationist, they embrace activities with the rest of the world and try to get from the rest of the world those goods and services that they are relatively less well positioned to produce. And we can go back to 1933. I mean, the previous caller referred to tariffs. These are the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, where the intent was to do precisely that, stay isolationist and build a fortress around America. And that didn't work very well. In fact, it exacerbated and lengthened the Great Depression, where millions suffered.
Kent Gardner, how would you answer Nicholas? Because I want our guests to respond, and then Nicholas can follow up. Go ahead, Kent.
Yeah, the first point I'd make is let's think about her history with petroleum products. Although, you know, we're very close to being actually self-sufficient in oil in the United States and in energy in general, that's not been the history long term. I mean, in 2017, for example, we imported $183 billion in petroleum products. So if we would decide to cut that off and decide we're going to simply work with what's within the United States, you know, gas prices would go up significantly immediately. Now, our trade deficit with petroleum is still substantial. It's about $92 billion. So that's one example. The other example, so you have to think about what we would do without oil being an obvious example. And also, we have to think about what we would lose in terms of our export markets. We have a surplus in aircraft engines of over $20 billion. The aerospace industry is a very large employer in the United States and pays very well. Those are great jobs. And that's a very important industry for us. And, you know, most of the business, not all the business, but a lot of the business is overseas. And so if we were to decide to throw up walls and just trade with ourselves, you know, the aerospace business would take a hit immediately. So it's always, you know, raising walls, it cuts two ways.
Okay. Rob Shum.
Well, I think approaching it from a slightly different angle is to point out that tariffs benefit capital and not workers, and that there are dynamic effects as well that we haven't talked about, that we've seen in countries that have followed through with the kind of logic that the caller has said has outlined. Let's say countries like Brazil or Argentina tried to do this with their auto industries. And what it benefits is, of course, a captive market for the manufacturers, where they don't innovate, where quality suffers, where products are shoddy and inferior, and consumers actually have to pay more for it. And so this is part of open competition is free trade. It is it gives the incentive for firms to innovate and to do and to come up with better products. And this is something that the steel industry in the United States failed. This is the whole problem, is that they didn't adopt new technologies. They didn't adopt new markets. They didn't innovate. And they failed. And this is just part of the capitalist system.
Okay, so it sounds like, Nicholas, and I'm going to try to sum up, if we went the way that you're describing as a bit of an isolationist, that we could see a significant more number of people out of work within this country and higher prices for what we are paying for to create within this country. Is that a short summation? Fair?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, Nicholas, anything you want to follow up with there?
Yeah, so for 2 points here. One, and I'm paraphrasing this, and I don't remember where the quote is from, but there are two people who believe in infinity, right? Astrophysicists and economists. I think to a certain extent, you have to limit use also. I think being isolationist would require less consumption, I guess. And I also don't call for total isolationism, obviously. I think we'd still need to export. And then trade to a certain extent, but I think, well, okay, has anyone here seen the Netflix documentary Rotten, the docuseries in which most of the show is talking about Chinese price gouging on little things like honey and garlic? But that matters. I think that closes the door on small farming and small production because it's so much cheaper to buy a ton of garlic from China than it is anywhere in this country. And I think that hurts so much of our industry. I think, obviously, petroleum we would need to outsource because, well, there's only so much in the world. We can only have so much. But I also think we need to navigate towards not using petroleum.
Well, Nicholas, there's nothing inconsistent with with reducing and being more efficient about how we use the resources, being good stewards of the world's bounty, and continuing to trade. And what I hear is, and I've heard this, you know, often, that people would like to be able to pick and choose what we trade with. You know, we want to be able to export, but we don't want to import these other things. And that does get us back to the 1930s, where we were being very selective about what we were willing to do, and hoping that our nation would be the winner and everyone else would be the loser.
But again, I hear Nicholas saying that, Kent, and I think it's not clear to Nicholas and others like him who feel that way what the problem would be. In other words, it sounds like they want to put us in the position that China sort of is in. And let's flip that. Let's do a lot more exporting, maybe a little bit of importing as necessary. What's it going to hurt?
Well, China also does a lot of importing. And that's one. If you take a look at what they've done in Africa, they've been very active because they need to import raw materials. They couldn't function without importing. But on balance, it's a little difficult to make you can make a selective case against trade, but in aggregate, when you roll it all together, again, economists universally think the trade's a positive.
Okay. Amit, go ahead.
And the other thing is it doesn't hurt to take a little look at recent history. In the post-World War II era, those developing countries of the world, and there were many of them, that decided to follow the so-called import-substituting industrialization policies, where the idea is we're not going to rely on our former colonial masters for our economic wherewithal, but we're going to rely on ourselves. The countries that followed these kinds of import-substituting industrialization policies compared to those that were outward-looking and believed in export-led growth, there's a dramatic difference in the economic accomplishments of these two different groups of nations, where Japan would be in one category, India would be in another category.
Okay, Nicholas, anything more you want to add before we let you go?
Well, yeah, I think there's something to be said about, and I recognize growth is necessary, but I don't think growth should be our end all. I think at a certain point we should start looking at sustainability, you know, and I indefinite growth is not sustainable.
Yeah, not at a certain point now. I mean, you're absolutely right, Nicholas. Can't disagree with you that sustainability is key. But there's nothing inconsistent with having free trade and having a sustainable economy.
Nicholas, I want to thank you for calling because I think his questions are the kinds of questions and comments we hear all the time here. And I don't think they're unreasonable at all. I think one of the reasons we put together this panel is because they've studied these kinds of issues for a long, long time, and I'm trying to better understand it myself. So, Nicholas, thank you, and please call again. I really appreciate you listening. David in Brighton, next up on the phone. Go ahead, David.
Hi. I don't know if this is a pro-tariff point, but one thing I've never understood exactly, what happened to the money that is gathered by the tariff? If it goes to the government, can't it be used to pay down national debt? Or isn't that a revenue-enhancing policy? In that sense, isn't it good? Can't tariffs be positive?
What happens to the money collected by tariffs?
There are generally two objectives to a tariff. One is to support the domestic import competing sector or sectors, and the second is to raise government revenue, as the caller just mentioned. Now, what Uncle Sam chooses to do with that government revenue is, in principle, many different things. So there is no reason to believe why some of the tariff revenue cannot be used to pay down the debt if Uncle Sam were to go, inclined to go in that direction. But again, I keep repeating this point, the problem is when you institute tariffs in our interconnected modern world, other countries, particularly our trading partners, are not just going to sit around and say, well, levy your tariff. We're getting screwed, if you will, in the vernacular. We will just sit around and do nothing. They will retaliate.
We've already seen some saber rattling to that regard, haven't we?
That's right. I mean, Jean-Claude Juncker of the European Union said that if you want to play stupid, we can play stupid too.
And he actually said those words,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We will levy tariffs on Levi's jeans, Harley Davidson motorcycles, and some other item that I can't remember.
Kentucky bourbon.
Yeah. Kentucky bourbon. It was Kentucky bourbon, wasn't it?
Right. Yes, yeah, because absolutely. Of McConnell and Ryan.
Right.
Oh,
Harley Davidson in Wisconsin.
The Europeans are very clever, you know. You don't want to bring a knife to a gunfight with the Europeans, if I mix my metaphors more.
I keep going back to Jim and Arundhati, who felt like this conversation is one-sided. And I really did work hard to try to find pro-tariff voices. Here is a voice that is not necessarily pro-tariff, but a voice that thinks we are overblowing this. It's Amit Badabial's old friend Matthew Stoller, who was on this program with Amit, I think, about a year ago. Matt is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, and he wrote the following about this issue of tariffs. He said, we've had massive trade deficits as a lubricant for global leadership for decades. This model stopped working for the American middle class in 1971. Trump is a symptom of its failure. John Maynard Keynes knew this would happen at Bretton Woods when the U.S. stupidly put all the burdens of trade adjustment on debtor nations. Starting in the 1960s, the Germans and Japanese ripped us off for decades, the Chinese too now. Vague national security goals were the real force behind NAFTA and China PNTR and the TPP and Korea FTA. In 1979, Volcker crushed American manufacturing to protect the dollar. This was not at the behest of the U.S., but of Europeans. So much social discord in America is taught as resulting from innate cultural conflicts without reference to the obvious context of deindustrialization and declining wages that started in the mid-1960s. And now Angela Merkel is the leader of the destructive, self-righteous mercantilists. The love of her politics among liberals was just rancid. I am a liberal internationalist, which I think it's clear we have to turn away from this model of sacrificing our middle class. That's Matt Stoller from the Open Markets Institute not saying the tariffs are a good idea. He says it's stupid, but it's not as big a deal as people say, and it's a symptom of decades of failure. So let's go around the table. Rob Shum, what do you say to that?
I would say it's interesting that he points out to 1971, and some observers of the current tariffs proposal point to the precedent there as being Richard Nixon doing something of similar scope in terms of tariffs. And again, economic analysis based on the data that came in afterwards says that again, contributed to stagflation and all of the problems of the 1970s again. Yes, I think one point that we have made is that this is something that we've seen before. Tariffs may not be as damaging as, you know, we don't want to be chicken littles or anything. But the one different thing that we haven't talked about, I think, about this tariff that is most serious is that it violates the sort of norms and practice of United States trade policy historically, which is not to use this national security exception for small reasons, this is the nuclear option, is that it's the form that the tariffs is taking. And that if we open the door, we're opening a Pandora's box. This is what we discourage everybody else from using. And it's something that China is always tempted to use, right? But, you know, this is something we had the moral high ground on. And we're giving that up and we're getting nothing in return.
Amit, do you agree or disagree with Matt's take on history there?
Well, there are a lot of things jumbled in together. I agree with some of them. But, you know, the point that I would like to make here is that any economic policy has income distribution implications. But, you know, why do we get so excited about tariffs? Tariff is one kind of economic policy. It just happens to be in the realm of trade. The reason is because it typically involves activities with foreign countries, and we have a whole lot of baggage that we bring to the table when we discuss what kinds of interactions we should or shouldn't have. And it's very important to keep that kind of cultural information, whatever they may be, in the background and look at tariffs from a narrow economic standpoint. And very closely related to this, I find that a lot of people have objections about free trade agreements because they say, well, this or that free trade agreement didn't create jobs, or it took jobs away. Well, the point to remember is the objective of a free trade agreement is not to create jobs. It's to promote trade. So you can like or dislike a free trade agreement, but you should like it on the metric that it's supposed to encourage. Now, of course, there are implications in other sectors of the economy, and employment is one such effect. But it's important to keep apples and oranges apart.
All right. So and Kent Stoller's point is not that tariffs are a good idea. He prefers his solution to the problem, as he sees it, going back to 1971, is to get back in the trust-busting method, to deconcentrate corporate power. But he says it's not surprising that someone would take, in his words, a dumb way out, which is tariffs.
Yeah, and I think that deconcentrating corporate power is a worthy goal, and I think that we've really lost our enthusiasm for trust busting. You know, competition really does work, and I think that we're confronting a very different kind of concentration right now in our tech giants.
All right, so last email comes from Dan. This is for Professor Badabial. He says, I'd agree that global economics need not be a zero-sum game, but in actuality, in its current globalized capitalist context, the game is played as one. Surely we're all aware that the world's elite, its investment bankers, its multinational corporations and their boards of directors, its private central banks and its corrupt political classes are perfectly resigned to creating classes of losers to be trampled by the moneyed interest. It's good business. In effect, the game will cease to be something other than zero-sum only when ethical factors become paramount, and that's just not what globalized capitalism is. Professor.
Okay, so there's a lot of information there. What I would like to point out is that it is true that the way in which our current corporate structure is organized, not only in the United States, but in the rest of the world, we have huge income disparities between people who make the most amount of money, who I'll call the CEO class, and say, the shop floor worker. And this is something that we need to do something about. There is absolutely no question about it. The increasing income inequality, about which many economists have written very, very eloquently. And this income inequality problem is a significantly broader problem than any agreement or disagreement one may have with this or that trade policy instrument. So we need a multi-pronged approach to make sure that the income that goes to the 1% or the top 2 or 3% of the economy does not continue to be so steep in their favor and against the vast majority of the people who are struggling to make ends meet. That calls for a significantly more holistic approach that simply cannot be addressed by any trade policy instrument, and trade ought not to be the whipping boy to address these much bigger and valid concerns.
And Rob, 20 seconds here. If Congressman Reid called you and said, did you hear me on Morning Edition? Did I get it right? You would tell him what?
I would tell him that if he's serious about dealing with any perceived threats with China, then again, this is the most counterproductive move possible, right? Because it's not targeting Chinese imports at all.
All right. And Kent, if callers like Dan are concerned about economic inequality and they're hitting international capitalism, are there better solutions out there?
Well, I think that there's often a tendency to conflate globalization with technological change, and that's a very hard problem to address.
And I asked you to do it when the music is playing, which is just totally gauche. I mean, we're going to need another several hours. Fortunately, I have your phone number. Thank you. Kent Gardner from the Center for Governmental Research. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Ahmed Badabial, professor from RIT. Thank you, professor. Always good having you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
And Professor Rob Shum from the College of Brockport. Thank you, Rob. Thanks for clearing the schedule for us.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, listeners, I promise we'll stick with this and try to continue answering your questions and addressing these issues as we go forward. Short break. More Connections coming up.